got a sprain or an itch, pain that's swelling or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. I call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
On December 3rd, 2020, the AMA, that's the American Medical Association, hosted the fourth webinar in their COVID-19 series, called What Physicians Need to Know. Well, having read the report, I felt that this should not be just for physicians. We all need to know just what is really happening with the COVID-19 pandemic, including the treatment, diagnosis, and prevention.
Recently, the emphasis, at least in the media, is related to prevention. By that I mean the vaccines, some of which have, according to the press, shown more than promise. And in fact, are making a lot of people, doctors included, asking themselves questions.
For example, why are the English getting the vaccine? That being one of the same vaccines that is now in front of the FDA for approval. And they're getting it even before we here in the United States do. And boiled down to its simplest form is the question, if they got it, why can't we get it? The first to speak in the webinar was Dr. June Bailey, President of the American Medical Association.
As we know, and as many experts predicted, record high surges occurring across the upper Midwest and really all over the country.
One of the speakers was Dr. Marks, who is the director of the Food and Drug Administration Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research.
Their job is to supposedly ensure that the COVID-19 vaccine that is ultimately produced in both safe and effective.
He went on after a lengthy, puffery talk stating that the FDA not only had to deal with the evaluation of safety effectiveness, making regulatory policy, but also do a variety of other things for vaccines, such as strain selection and reference standard production. They also want to make sure that the finished product, that is the vaccine that is brought to the public, is what it says it is.
They have also been tasked with helping to advance vaccine manufacturing technologies, such as by trying to start to apply newer manufacturing technologies.
They're also trying to ensure public confidence in any vaccine that the FDA approves. And he went on to say that they have to contend with politics as well as social media in order to convince the public of the safety and effectiveness of any product that's approved by the FDA.
Remember how we talk about how the virus works and in general how some of the vaccines work, that is, targeting the spike protein or S protein. There are some candidates in very early stages that are looking at both spike and N proteins.
Many people are wary of any vaccines that used live or whole killed viruses in their studies. However, those vaccines now in front of the FDA do not. The most advanced candidates as of December now are the two mRNA candidates that we have. That's the one from Pfizer-BioNTech and one from Moderna.
You may be wondering how a process that normally takes several years to complete before a vaccine is approved can be ready in less than a year. It is understood that traditional vaccine development is a highly de-risk activity.
One reason is that normally vaccines don't make companies a lot of money generally. So the profit motive is not there usually for these manufacturers.
So they are going to try to reduce the cost of research and development by spreading out the risk over time and only advancing from one stage to a next after they know that it's likely that their product is going to work.
Research can be time-consuming and ultimately very costly, especially if after a long period, the vaccine fails. Also, one often doesn't see scale-up of manufacturing till very late in the game. And that means that one can be close to an approval and still doesn't have a lot of vaccine available for distribution. Now, that is normally the way vaccines are developed.
Normally, you have the more definitive safety and efficacy studies and large efficacy studies and commercial scale manufacturing starting towards the very end.
But what has been done as part of Operation Warp Speed is the collapsing of some of the steps. Now, you can't eliminate things necessarily, but what you can do is work at risk.
One interesting thought that could be detrimental to the spread of pandemic is the possibility or fact that just having a vaccine could paradoxically lead to spread of the virus simply because people change their behavior to do less social distancing and taking more risks, such as less hand washing and less use of masks.
Lucky is the fact about 95% of the serious adverse events with vaccines become apparent within around 6 weeks, and certainly within 2 months of the administration of the vaccine. So this at least helps us feel comfortable that when we deploy these vaccines, that there's anything that's in a significant way of serious adverse event, that we will have seen it.
One problem with the educated guessing is the concern whether the immune protection provided by the vaccine and the antibodies produced truly correlates to a clinical prevention of disease.
I was about to report the reaction of many, including physicians and not just politicians, who have criticized the FDA for shuffling their feet on the approval, especially now that Great Britain has already approved and started providing the vaccine to their country. However, in the last 3 days, the FDA's advisory panel gave the green light to the Pfizer vaccine.
This means that the agency will likely okay the vaccine's use, paving the way for healthcare workers to begin getting shots next week. Now, the FDA is expected to make its formal announcement in the coming days.
Here is how the conversation went at the FDA. The moderator of the meeting said, "Let's pull up the voting question on the side. Based on the totality of scientific evidence available, do the benefits of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine outweigh its risks for use in individuals 16 years of age and older? You'll have 2 minutes to cast your vote after the question is read." And you know, the vote passed. So last Thursday, just 2 days ago, Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine passed a critical milestone when a panel of experts formally recommended that the FDA authorize the vaccine.
The FDA was expected to grant an emergency use authorization today, although last-minute legal or bureaucratic requirements could push the announcement to Sunday or later.
It has been told to us that the initial shipment of 6.4 million doses will leave warehouses within 24 hours of being cleared by the FDA, according to the federal officials. And then remember that each person must receive 2 doses. So about half of those doses will be sent across the country, and the other half will be reserved for the initial recipients to receive their second dose around 3 weeks later. It has been announced by the Trump administration that the CDC will oversee the vaccine distribution process and provide guidance to states and will ultimately be responsible for shipping out of the vaccines.
The states will then partner with their local health departments and refer to the guidance as they develop their own vaccine distribution process.
The arrival of the first vaccines is just the beginning of a complex, probably months-long distribution plan coordinated by federal and local health authorities, as well as large hospitals and pharmacy chains that, if successful, will help return a grieving and economically depressed country back to, well, we hope, some semblance of normal, maybe by summer. I've already read that Walmart, CVS, and Walgreens have announced that they will be administering the vaccines across the country. By the way, Bahrain and Canada have already approved the vaccine.
The U.S. authorization of Pfizer's vaccine is expected to be followed soon by one for Moderna's version. Remember that they use similar technology to Pfizer.
some have had concerns since regulators in Britain recommended this week that people with a history of anaphylactic allergic reactions to medicines and foods not get the vaccine while they investigate two cases of allergic reactions among healthcare workers in their country.
However, Pfizer officials said there were no cases of serious allergies reactions in the trial of 44,000 participants, but remember that people with a history of allergic reactions to vaccines were excluded from the Pfizer study.
At the meeting, Dr. Paul Offit, MD, asked Pfizer to conduct a separate study of people with a history of severe allergies because, according to him, quote, this issue is not going to die until we have a better data.
We have already been informed that only a specific group of people will be given the opportunity to receive the vaccine initially. So the main question of the general public is, if I live in the U.S., when can I get the vaccine?
Actually, the exact order of vaccine recipients may vary state by state. Most will likely put medical workers and residents of long-term care facilities first. So your first question may actually be, when can I return to normal life after being vaccinated?
That is a good question, but a hard one to really answer since it depends on a lot of other things which we have already touched on.
Life will return to normal only when society as a whole gains enough protection against the coronavirus. Now, once countries authorize a vaccine, they'll only be able to vaccinate a few percent of their citizens, at most in the first couple of months. The unvaccinated majority will still remain vulnerable to getting infected.
It is also possible for people to spread the virus without even knowing they are infected because they experience only mild symptoms or none at all.
And here is one fact that most do not realize. Scientists don't yet know if the vaccines also block the transmission of the coronavirus. So for the time being, even vaccinated people will need to wear masks, avoid indoor crowds, and so on.
Once enough people, and I emphasize the word enough, once enough people get vaccinated, it will become very difficult for the coronavirus to find vulnerable people to infect.
Depending on how quickly we as a society achieve that goal, life might not start approaching something like normal until, well, maybe the fall of 2021, a long way off. The clinical trials that delivered these results were not designed to determine whether vaccinated people could still spread the coronavirus without developing symptoms. That still remains a possibility. We know that people who are naturally infected by the coronavirus can spread it while they are not experiencing any cough or any symptoms.
Researchers will be intensely studying the question as the vaccine rolls out. And you know, in the meantime, even vaccinated people will need to think of themselves as possible spreaders.
If you're wondering if the vaccine is going to hurt, it should be no different than the ones you've already gotten. Tens of thousands of people have already received the vaccines, and none of them have reported any serious health problems.
But some of them have felt short-lived discomfort, including aches and flu-like symptoms that typically last a day. It's possible that people may need to plan to take a day off work or school after their second shot.
While these experiences aren't pleasant, they're a good sign. They're the result of your own immune system encountering the vaccine and mounting a potent response that will provide long-lasting immunity. There are people who are concerned if these mRNA vaccines change the genes, and the answer is no.
The vaccines from Moderna and Pfizer use a genetic molecule to prime the immune system. That genetic molecule, known as mRNA, is eventually destroyed by the body.
Finally, what happens is the cell uses the RNA, that's the mRNA, to make proteins from the coronavirus, which can then stimulate the immune system.
At any moment, each of our cells may contain hundreds of thousands of mRNA molecules, which they produce in order to make proteins of their own. Once those proteins are made, our cells then shred the mRNA with special enzymes.
Now, under normal circumstances, this mRNA molecule can only survive in the cells for a matter of minutes.
The mRNA in vaccines is actually engineered to withstand the cell's enzymes a bit longer so that the cells can make extra virus proteins and prompt a stronger immune response.
But the mRNA can only last for a few days at most before they are destroyed. Be aware that people who are severely immunocompromised may not get the COVID-19 vaccine.
But people with weakened immune systems can benefit from the coronavirus vaccine even if they have to wait longer to get it. Now, this includes people with cancer or HIV, or even those who have had organ transplants. Other groups who will not receive the vaccines until other tests are performed are bone marrow recipients and people taking corticosteroids or other medicines that suppress the immune system.
Remember that both the chickenpox and herpes zoster vaccine aren't recommended for people with severely compromised immune systems.
Of the more than 100 vaccines being developed to protect against COVID-19, only a few use a live attenuated coronavirus virus. These vaccines are still, though, in the very early stages of development. They do not come from Pfizer or Moderna.
Many feel that if we hit 70 to 75% of the population receiving the coronavirus vaccination, then we could reasonably assume that everybody else is going to be protected.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. Hello, I'm Dr. Harold Lasky. I have been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 34 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Tulsa Welding School and the old Pottsburg Post Office.
We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show.
Well, now that we've consumed one half of our show on vaccines, let's get on to another subject for a moment. Many people use stevia as a sugar substitute, but many are questioning even this one as to its implications in your health. Is the sugar substitute stevia bad for our health? Good question. New research into this plant-based sweetener, stevia, indicates that this sugar substitute may have negative implications for gut health.
Scientists have, for a long time, considered stevia a safe sugar alternative, but a new study raises the question of whether it can be harmful to your gut health.
First, what is stevia? You probably already know that there are multiple sugar substitutes. These include several artificial sweeteners like sucralose, aspartame, and saccharin, and the sugar alcohols called xylitol and erythritol.
But some people use plant-based options to replace sugar, and stevia is one such sweetener that is widely available.
People have used the plant stevia as a sweetener for hundreds of years. It was apparently discovered in Brazil as well as Paraguay and now grows all over the world. Stevia is up to 300 times more sweet than table sugar, so only a very small amount is necessary to achieve a sweetening effect. Not only that, stevia is a zero-calorie substitute, whereas other artificial sweeteners may have a few calories.
Another big benefit to stevia is that it has a glycemic index of less than 1. That means it does not raise blood sugar the way a few alternative sugar substitutes do.
Over the last several decades, many studies have linked other substitutes, such as sucralose and saccharin, with tumor growth in mice, although these effects are still not confirmed in humans. But until this new study, research on stevia had not previously uncovered any serious negative health implications.
Although people generally understand the importance of maintaining a moderate weight and engaging in best practices for heart health they sometimes overlook gut health.
According to Dr. Elizabeth Homan of the Infectious Disease Division at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital, it's most important to our health, and that is our gastrointestinal or GI system, but may have even more far-reaching effects on our well-being. The digestive system is home to various types of bacteria. Some of these bacteria help keep our bodies healthy. That's right. Some bacteria are enormously helpful for our health and well-being.
To maintain a healthy and balanced gut is important in many ways.
Some gut bacteria can prevent inflammation. Others actually protect against certain types of cancer. And still others reduce symptoms associated with rheumatoid arthritis.
There are various ways to maintain a healthy gut, one of which is to avoid the overuse of antibiotics.
You've probably at some time been told by your physician that antibiotics can affect the good bacteria living in your gut.
Avoiding foods that can harm gut health, such as processed foods and red meat, is also important.
And people can take probiotics, eat foods high in fiber, eat fermented foods like yogurt or kombucha to promote good gut health.
We have already told you some of the benefits of using stevia as a sugar substitute. How about the negative aspects of the plant?
New studies have suggested that stevia can have a negative effect on gut health. There are two forms of stevia on the market. There's the commercialized herb supplement and the purified stevia extract. The gut has something called quorum sensing, or QS pathways. These pathways enable bacteria molecules to communicate with each other, which is important in terms of microbial regulation. The researchers found that the stevia herb supplement had an inhibitory effect on bacterial communication, or QS.
The purified stevia extract showed possible interruption of some forms of bacterial communication.
Luckily, neither form of stevia showed any killing of bacteria in the gut. The lead researcher said that this is just initial research, which indicates the more research is warranted before the food industry replaces sugar and artificial sweeteners with stevia and its extracts. Now, here's an interesting aside. Some scientists have estimated that there are 10 times more microbial cells in the body than there are human cells.
We have talked about and mentioned two terms on previous shows, those being microbiota and microbiome. These terms have been used interchangeably.
The human microbiota is made up of trillions of cells, including bacteria, viruses, and fungi. The biggest populations of microbes in our bodies resides in the gut. The microbial cells and their genetic material, called the microbiome, live with humans from birth.
And as we stated previously, this relationship is vital to normal health. The microorganisms living inside the gastrointestinal tract amount to around 4 pounds of biomass.
And every individual has a unique mix of species. The microbiota is important for nutrition, immunity, and effects on the brain and behavior. But it is implicated in a number of diseases that cause a disturbance in the normal balance of microbes. The microbiome is actually the name given to all the genes inside the microbial cells.
Every human being harbors anywhere between 10 trillion and 100 trillion microbial cells in a symbiotic relationship. That means that they benefit us and we benefit them.
Now, this benefits both the microbes and their hosts. That's us. As long as the body is in a healthy state. Estimates vary, but there could be over 1,000 different species of microorganisms that make up the human microbiota.
There are plenty of projects trying to decode the human genome by sequencing all human genes. In a similar way, the microbiome has been subject to intensive efforts to unravel all its genetic information.
Now, we'll talk more about this brain-gut connection and why the gut is often called our second brain, as well as a four-letter word, cancer, in our next Hey Doc show.
I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. We've come to the end of another Hey Doc show.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.